Session number 12319.
Mr. Card, reel three.
I say I enjoyed working with the Greeks because for some reason or other they seemed to sort of take to me. I think partly because on one occasion, about the first or second day I had this group of people, I'd marched them along the road. I knew they liked to sing, so I started whistling a song which I thought was a French song called Madelon, something about a French soldier singing about the glories of his song, sword called Madelon. And suddenly these people started smiling and they started whistling the same tune. And I thought, this is strange, so I suddenly carried on. And when we arrived at the lecture room where we were going to be for the lecture, the interpreter, Babis, turned around to me and said, "How do you know a Greek song?" I said, "Is that a Greek song?" He said, "Oh yes," he said, "very old Greek song." And he told me the name of it. So I said, "Oh, well, just one of those things one picks up, I suppose," and that was it. I didn't crack on to them that so hard, but they thought I was, the sunshine out of my rear, I suppose, because of this. And I got on very well with them. They were very enthusiastic, and I'd say they belonged to the Greek Sacred Heart Squadron, who was equivalent to the Special Air Service, and were all officers. And the colonel, who was in my section, would do perform an exercise with me, such as doing a forward landing or whatever, off a piece of equipment, get up, pull a fag out, and wander around the rest of the school, rest of the course, to see how the rest of his men were doing, puffing on his cigarette, and come back to me, ready to do another exercise. On his first parachute descent, we had no balloons out there, of course, all our descents were done from aircraft. On his first parachute descent, he tried to imitate one of the instructors and do a stand-up landing and sprained his ankle, for which he was very, very apologetic to me and explained that he was over 60 at the time, so, aged men like them must expect injuries, I suppose. There was a chap older than that who did, of course, a Greek air commodore, I believe, or an air marshal. He was about 70. He was trained by Ginger Avis. Anyway, these... And so when they finished the course, they went back to their unit. We had another group come along, also Greeks, who reported in and said they'd been sent down and told by their colonel to ask for Sergeant Cady as their instructor. Now, the CO at that time was Squadron Leader Phil Murphy, who had been my instructor when I did the parachute course, the officer in charge of my course, when I did my course in Ringway. And I think he rather sort of looked upon me quite favourably because I was one of the youngest, I think I was the youngest member of the staff. Well, I was the youngest member of the staff there. And he sort of kept a fatherly eye on me, I suppose. But he said to our school warrant officer, a chap named Turnbull, Jerry Turnbull, he said, "Who the hell's this bloke KD?" And he said, "Oh, it's Alf over there." "Oh, what are they calling that for?" So we told him the story and he started laughing. He said, "Oh, anyway, some Greeks want training by him." He thought it was amusing that these people should come up and ask for me to train them. And, we had not only Greeks, we had other nationalities, we had some Iraqi levies. And I found all these people, there was no difference between any of them. The language problem was there, but you could get around that by saying, it was all sort of done by watching, demonstration. And then you'd sort of try and get across, you'd sort of pick up various bits of, say, Arabic or Greek or whatever, and get it across to them in that way.
Was there much difference between the parachutists and the SOE agents as regards your job in training them?
No, except that, as I say, they were, 9 times out of 10, they were foreign.
The SOE agent.
Yes, SOE agents. They also did a shorter course. They wanted these people quickly, so their course was of that nature, a four-jump course, and they would go, except the English element, which were like Spider Lawson, Bill Weatherly, and people like that who were wireless operators with the military missions. And they would do the full paratroop course, but the others, we knew that they would come in and do just the four jump course because they had to get away quickly.
So there wasn't any difference in character between them and the parachuters?
No, they were sometimes they would tend to be a little older and perhaps not as agile and gymnastic, shall we say, as the ordinary soldier, because the ordinary soldier would tend to be younger, fitter, and more gymnastic, whereas these people were, well, they had to be ordinary, look ordinary, otherwise it would have been suspicious. They'd have been stuck out like a sore thumb if you had someone marching around like a soldier behind, say, in Bari in Italy. So I think they tend to be more civilian. You knew that the discipline was not the same, that they didn't march around the same way as the soldier did.
Less muscular.
Less muscular, yes. But they were... They performed very well. And we just saw them once and that was it. We never knew what happened. I often wonder what happened to some of them. The chap I mentioned the first time, a young lad, I did see him again once. I saw him in Cairo, where I went on leave from Ramat David once, and walking down one of the main streets in Cairo, this chap met me, and he said, "Oh, hello," he said, "what are you doing here?" So I told him, "Oh," he said, "I'm between jobs, I'll show you around Cairo," and he did, because he'd been born in Alexandria. His mother was English and his father was Greek, but he'd been born in Alexandria, and he knew all the way around, you know, the way around. He used to take me to Groppi's for ice cream, and we'd go to, he found a very good Arabic restaurant, take me in the evening for a meal. And on one occasion, see it on the films, which is perfectly true, we were walking, I'd arranged to meet him by a serviceman's club. We'd been out for a cup of coffee one morning. We were walking back, and he suddenly stopped and said, "I'll have to go and see a man now." He said, "I got to report at this time." He says, "My office is around here." And he disappeared through a door, which happened to be an Arab laundry. He just turned and said, "Cheerio," went up the stairs, and that was it. And I thought, well, you see that in film, of people going in and laundering. This actually happened. And he belonged to this organisation called MO4. I saw him later when we were moving from Palestine to Italy, and he was on the boat. And then he had been commissioned. All the time I knew him, when he's on the course with me, he'd only wore the rank of a private. They're usually in the intelligence corps, but I'd say when I met him on that boat, he was a lieutenant. Where he went to from there, I have no idea. But I'm trying to digress a bit. Some of the other people we had to train, we had a group of people called the Long Range Desert Group. Now, the Long Range Desert Group were very similar to the Special Air Service, and there was a lot of rivalry between the Long Range Desert Group and the Special Air Service. The Long Range Desert Group were composed of, I think at this stage, about four squadrons. There was a Rhodesian squadron, South African squadron, a New Zealand squadron, and a British squadron. And you can imagine, they were mainly made up of people from those particular areas. In other words, the Rhodesian squadron tended to be all from Rhodesia, South Africa, the South African. I made the mistake of working with my first Rhodesian squadron and calling them South Africans, which they were quite disgusted and said, "We're not South Africans, we are Rhodesians. South Africa is our penal colony," something that I faked. They were very... a lot of rivalry between them and the Special Air Service, in that they said that the Special Air Service, in their view, was a lot of cowboys. Their job was to go out and rescue them. The Special Air Service used to go out in jeeps in the desert, and very often they would liaise with the Long Range Desert Group to be brought back. And the Long Range Data Group had people like Lieutenant Mike Sadler, who was a navigator and evidently one of the big navigational aces behind the El Alamein operation, and that he was, they helped to sort of plot all the routes through and all this sort of, found the best way of attacking and all this sort of business. And their Long Range Data Group's main job was to sort of sit in places and watch and report back of what was happening from the enemy side, the transport, troops and all this sort of business. I think they were raised by a gentleman by the name of Colonel Lloyd Owen, I'm not certain. And Lloyd Owen was either he was or he was associated with a chap who worked in the desert, the Sahara Desert, and they used to map routes, they'd plot routes through the desert pre-war. They did a lot of archaeological studies there. So when this unit was formed, of course, well, then they were ideally situated for it, the ideal people for it, because they knew all the ways in and out, if you like. They knew where the sand was worst, where they could traverse properly. So that's why I think he got the job. We had another, we had several groups actually, besides the Long Range Desert Group and the Special Air Service. There were a lot of private, what are called private armies. You might have heard of Popsky's Private Army, which is something very, very similar. We trained a few of those, not many. There was also a unit raised called the Raiding Support Regiment, who were artillery people. And when we, just before we moved from Ramat David to Italy, we started training the Raiding Support Regiment. These were all mainly heavy artillery people, or light artillery. And the idea was that, I suppose, they would go ashore in various places in the Balkans to lend heavy support to the people, to the agents who required them. We could call them a private army. I think when the war finished, they all merged in with the Special Air Service. We had another group called a Special Boat Service. That was actually an offshoot of the Special Air Service formed by Lieutenant Jellicoe. He formed the Special Boat Service and we trained those. And on one occasion I had 9 Royal Marines and 1 sailor. And they had to spend a lot of time tearing them apart, because you know what sailors and Royal Marines are. My Royal Marines wouldn't move on the first day. I had a corporal in charge of these men. And I said, come on, Marines, line up. And they said, no, they just stood there. I said, excuse me, corporal. He came up to attention and said, Flight Sergeant, I was a Flight Sergeant then. He said, Flight Sergeant, do you mind? We are Royal Marines, not Marines. So after that, I have always called them Royal Marines, because that's their proper title. And they were a very, very good group of men. You've probably heard of Sparks, the Royal Marine, the name of Sparks, who was, I think, the only survivor now of the operation on the Giron River, I think, where the Cockleshell Heroes. Now, I'm not too certain where the Royal Marine Sparks was trained. He may have been trained out in the Middle East, but I'd love to find out. I don't know. Because I never knew what happened to these men that I had. They just, I said, when we moved, they moved, and that was it. But the Long Range Desert Group that I had, about toward the end of 43, around about August, September time, 43, there was a lot of activity. I lost a Dakota. The way I lost a Dakota was because they suddenly decided to move this squadron of Dakotas in. Because they were going to do, well, we thought just an operation exercise somewhere. We also had a squadron of Spitfires came in. And we didn't know what they were here for. But the officer, the commander in charge of the small unit of aeroplanes that we used for parachute dropping, we had our own small unit, came up to our boss one day and said, look, we're short of staff. Could one of your instructors... Can you instruct in turn to sit in air traffic control? So all they've got to do is when these we're expecting these aeroplanes in, and just mark them down. So I got landed with a job one Saturday, and I was counting these aeroplanes in, and someone phoned up and said, "Oi, Dakota so-and-so, has it landed?" So I looked at the board, "No, not here." A bit later, "Has it aircraft came in yet?" "No, still not arrived." There was a lot of panic going around then, people started flying around the place, and suddenly it all went quiet, so I phoned up and said, "The Dakota's not arrived yet." "All right, we found it." It had landed, not bothered to report in to me, just parked round the corner, and that was it. People thought it had gone missing. So I had my leg pulled for losing this Dakota. The interesting thing with this squadron was this. I've had coincidences, all my life on this. First coincidence was we had a group of people in from Malta. They all were ex-Cheshire Regiment. And they'd volunteered for paratroops. Now, some of them unkindly said, or jokingly said, that the reason why they volunteered for the paratroops was to get out of Malta because they were better than being bombed. So they thought if they could volunteer for the paratroops, they'd come over here, they knew we'd have to come to Palestine for training. Anyway, I was finishing work one day, and I was just taking my first intake in, and I saw a young chap stood on a bit of a rise because he worked outdoors. And as I got to him, I thought his face was familiar. And I realised, before I joined the Royal Air Force, I worked at Battersby's. I worked in the print room, and the chap there with me, called Bennett, I used to call him Popeye Bennett for some reason or other. And in 1938, we were discussing joining the services, and I said, "Well, I want to join the Air Force, I've been trying to join. My father wouldn't let me, he'd now relented and let me join. So I'm going to join the Air Force. What about you, Popeye?" "No," he says, "I'm not going to fly in aeroplanes. Don't like flying in aeroplanes. I'm going to join the TA." So we joined the local TA. And this fellow I happened to meet was that same lad. He decided that perhaps it might not be such a bad idea to jump out of aeroplanes. But he wasn't trained by me. He was trained by another chap, but he was on the same course. And then he went to an outfit called the 11th Battalion, which again dropped at Arnhem, but he survived. Now, at the same time, we had this squadron in, and I was in the mess, and a young sergeant pilot stood at the bar, and I went up, an orange squat or something. I looked at this chap, and I thought, "Well, your face is familiar, and in the services, you're moving around, you meet different people on different stations." So I said, "Excuse me," I said, but "did you come over on the Queen Mary?" Because a lot of pilots came over with us. "No, no," he said, "I've only been out here a couple of months." "Oh." I said, "What station? You've been at Wimslow?" "No." And I went through all the RAF stations he'd been on and I'd been on. "No." And I said, "Well, I come from Stockport. Where do you come from?" "Crewe." I said, crying out loud, "Edlaston Road School." He said, "Yeah." He said, "Alfie Card." His name was Norman Simpson. Now, when I was a kid, before we moved from... I lived at Crewe until I was 12. And I used to go to Edlaston Road School and I used to sit in the same desk as this lad called Norman Simpson, who was now a pilot. Another friend of mine was also, it turned out to be, he was also out in the Middle East, but he was a navigator. And I thought, well, what a coincidence. I'd left Crewe at 12 and not seen him for about 5 or 6 years, and I should walk into him in the bar. And the sad thing is that not long after this, he came to me about 3 or 4 weeks after. He said, "I'm posted," he said, "I'm going flying Blenheims in the desert." And about a month after this, I saw one of the chaps who was on this squadron. I said, "What happened to Norman Simpson?" "Oh, didn't you know? He's bought it," he said. "He crashed during a night landing in a Blenheim." So I think, you know, I had to meet that fella. Anyway, we found out the reason why the Dakotas were in, because a unit of the 11th Battalion... First of all, this course I had a course of long-range desert group at the time, and they were suddenly whipped off. They were going to do a parachute descent on the Saturday. On the Friday, they'd all gone. We found out later that they'd been taken by boat and landed on different islands in the Dodecanese, because they dropped paratroops on the different islands in the Dodecanese Islands, and the special air service, special boat service, long-range desert group had gone in first to sort of clear the way, if you like. And the Spitfires had also gone over and landed on Kos. And, well, everything was dead as far as we were concerned because we had no courses at the time. Our course had gone away. They'd not done the parachute descent. So we went for the next course coming in. And then we were all told to report to the flight commander's headquarters. And we got there, and there's all these air crew were in there milling around the place. And we sat at the back, wondering what the dickens we were there for. And suddenly it dawned on us that we were going to go on an operation that particular day, supplying these islands with fuel and one thing or another. And they read our names out, and I went out. I was attached with a crew with another lad, another one of our instructors, who I won't tell you, won't mention his name. You'll see why later. Anyway, we were detailed for this aeroplane. That night, we weren't told, all we were told, we were flying in an aeroplane somewhere. That night, we reported to the aeroplane about 10 o'clock at night, put our gear aboard. We took a parachute with us, well, just in case, you know, you never know what happens. But the reason we were, haven't turned out while we were doing all this was because they tried to resupply these the Dodecanese Islands, and Kos in particular, by daylight. But with the Germans being on roads, it was a bit tricky because the Germans wouldn't let them do it, and they were trying to shoot them down. And one of the aircraft was shot down as it was trying to drop supplies. So we went at night time. And as we got aboard our aircraft, the pilot and the crew got on. The pilot said to us, don't smoke, lads. He said, this is full of octane fuel. And I looked, and then I found out what I'd got. And we'd got a whole batch of, it'd been loaded up with bundles of the jerry cans full of octane fuel for the Spitfires. We were based on Kos. Had about four or five of them together, and the parachute on the top, the static line. And the pilot said, get him out as quick as you can. He said, I don't want to hang about with this lot. So we took off. So I went up front and sat with the wireless operator and the navigator. And I said to the navigator, when he got a spare moment, I said, where are we going? He said, Kos. I said, where the hell's Kos? He said, oh, a little place there. He'd point on the map. I said, oh, that's it. He said, yes. So I said, we ploughed on through the night. And then I went back, had a word with my mate, went up front again, and I heard the pilot turn around to the wireless operator and said, well, the navigator rather first said, we've got about 5 minutes to go. And the pilot turned around to the wireless operator and said, get the light of the call of the day, or the call of the night. This is a signal. You had to fire the very cartridge, had to fire to let the people know you were friendly down below, otherwise they'd shoot at you. So I thought, oh, we're getting ready now. So I went back to my mate and said, come on, better get the first lot ready, I said, because we're only got a few minutes to go. So we got the first load ready by the door, ready to throw out. Then there was this loud bang and a flash, and this bloke, well, panicked really. He said, running back, he said, we're in it. I said, shut up, you fool. I said, we're all right. He said, that's just the cartridge. I was all right, I knew what was going to happen. I said, it's just the very light's gone off, said the colour of the night. Oh, we said. I said, come on. And the red came on, the green lights, and we started throwing the stuff out. Went round again. Took about four runs, I think. And then the signalman was watching, and as soon as all had gone out, said, that's it, it's away. And as we turned off and came back, make back home, I heard a loud bang, like, just like a little dustbin lid clanged somewhere. So I couldn't think of it. Everything seemed to be all right, so I never bothered. I just sat down and sort of, I thought, we'll have a bit of a kip till we get back. So we just lay down on the seats at the front. When we landed, the first thing my mate and I thought about was to get back, get our breakfast, and then get to bed. And I saw all the crew clustered around the back end of the aeroplane, and pointing and looking. So, but I didn't bother. I don't know what it was, whether someone had, you know, I couldn't think who, whether someone had shot at us, or whether it'd been hit, or whether it was from the ground, or what, or whether it was just one of those things. So I never found out what happened. But there's an interesting sequel to all this. This was in 1943. Now, I came back in 1945, when I was in Italy, and 1947, I think it was, I was sent for by the CO We were then at Upper Heyford, and the CEO of the parachute crew was sent for me, and another chap named Flatiron Quinn. Flatiron Quinn and I went down there. This chap was named Shields, saw us waiting outside of his office. He said, "Come in, got something for you two." So he said to Paddy Quinn, he said, "Here you are, Paddy," he said. "You are such a number, Flight Sergeant Quinn." And Paddy said, "Well, you know I am." He said, "I was with you." He said, "I've got to ask you this." He said, "You are, that is your number, rank, name." He said, "Yes, that's it." "Here, I'll sign this." He said, "Oh." He said, "Oh, that's your certificate for your mentioned dispatches. You've got mentioned dispatches." So I said, "I wonder what he wants me for then, because I hadn't got one." So he said, "You are 636-219 Flight Sergeant Alfred Walter Card." I said, "Yes, that's me." He said, "Sign here." I said, "What for?" He said, "Sign here for this." I said, "I haven't got one of those." He said, "That's your bloody name and number, isn't it?" I said, "Yes." "Sign here and get out," he said. I said, "No." I said, "I didn't know. No one told me I'd been mentioned dispatches." And later on, I was told that on that operation, none of the instructors, and it hurt me really, because none of the instructors had received any decoration, any award at all for that particular operation, nothing. We didn't really deserve it because it's a one-off operation. And the lads who'd been out there before had done all these operations and got absolutely nothing. Yet here was me. It turned out I'd gone on this one operation and been warden of mentioned dispatches. I didn't think I'd done any more than anybody else. But so I just don't know what it was for. They just had to give it to somebody, I think, because I was just the lucky one. Anyway, that was that to the Dodecanese operation. I said, a couple of nights later, I went over again in the Hudson, but this time our radio went wrong, so we were not able to go through. We had to land in Cyprus and then come back again. And that night was the last night we did, because Markwell, their aircraft was ordered to land and pick somebody up or somebody injured or something. And he got off the island, evidently, and about an hour after he left the island, or maybe less than that, the Germans evidently dropped about 200 paratroops and recaptured the Dodecanese Islands again. The long-range desert group people that I was training were captured there. I heard about them. And I met one of them when we moved across to Italy, to a place called Gioia del Col. And he told me his story. He said he'd been captured by the Germans, taken to Greece. They were put on this train, and he said, "And your training came in very useful," he said, "because this train slowed down," he said, "it went round the bend." So I said to the lads, I said, "Come on, lads, off." And they all jumped off, rolled down the hill, and got away. And he said he'd been living for about a year off the Germans. He was raiding a German camp at night, pinching their rations, until they could get back to British lines, which they did eventually. After that, things went a bit dead. We were doing a lot of drops around the place, Spitfire weeks. And then the 10th Battalion, the 11th Battalion, the 156 Battalions, they were posted back home. I think they stopped off in North Africa or in Sicily or whatever on the way first. But then they came home.